Namaste. This is Farah Nasrallah, the producer of Drishti Point Yoga Podcasts. Drishti Point has been recording podcasts since 2006, and we have over 300 podcasts that we are currently uploading to this site and others. Please be sure to visit our website, drishtipoint.ca, for the top 100 podcasts. We hope this podcast will nourish your mind and open your heart. Namaste.
This is Farah, and it is now 5:01, and we have a great show planned for you today. First will be an interview that we didn't get a chance to finish last week, and that was with Louis Etting. You're listening to Drishti Point, and today we have Louis Etting, who is a yoga teacher in the Iyengar tradition, and who is the director of a yoga studio called the Yoga Space, which I've just heard is celebrating its 10th anniversary. So congratulations and welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
So, Louis, we here on Drishti Point, you know, and here in Vancouver, there are so many different styles of yoga, and we bring in teachers from many different traditions, but we've never actually had a teacher who is in the Iyengar tradition. So can you tell us a little bit about your own path to yoga and a little bit about how you would define how you teach in the Iyengar style?
Well, first of all, you know, yoga is yoga. And then there are many different traditions that have developed over time. The name Iyengar comes from BKS Iyengar, who is a teacher still alive in India. And he himself was not that keen in the beginning on having yoga called Iyengar yoga. But the name really came from his students, who felt that his contribution was so particular over the century that they wanted to mark it by using the word Iyengar yoga.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the name comes from. It's a family living in Pune in India.
And was your first introduction to yoga through an Iyengar teacher?
It just happened to be that way. I wanted to go to yoga classes. This was probably 25 years ago. And I lived not too far from the False Creek Community Center on Granville Island. And I just walked in for a class. The teacher who was teaching there at the time, her name is Wendy Davis. She's still teaching there.
Wow.
And she was my first teacher, and I was enthralled with the classes. They were very calm, but very profound, and I never went anywhere else. It worked for me. And it was probably a little bit before there was so much choice in yoga. There were not that many classes around.
Mm-hmm.
So to have found something that felt so extremely right to me was a treat, and I just stayed there. I never went anywhere all the years.
Were you a student for a long period of time before you became a teacher?
Well, yes. In the Iyengar tradition, becoming a teacher is a very slow process anyway. I would say typically people can study 6-7 years before they even go into the teacher training program, which is then another 3 to 5 years. So it's very typical to have somebody who's been doing the yoga for 8 years before they would come in, begin to teach. And in my case, I was happy to be a student for probably about 8 years before I felt the need to take it somewhere else. And when I first started teaching, when I first started wanting to teach, it was more that I wanted to deepen the practice. It wasn't that I was so intent on teaching. And that's something that I've noticed change quite a lot over the last decade or so, where because yoga is around so much more, I think that there's so many studios, there's so much activity, there's one on every corner, and I see that people teach much faster.
Oh, definitely. I think, you know, students, you know, yesterday I talked to someone who had never taken a yoga class and saw the advertisement of a teacher training program and started asking me about it. And I said, well, first, it's important to take a class. I mean, I think also to practice for a while as well, but I think that's definitely true. And then did you go to India? for your training?
Our training is, it's an international program, but it's structured so that you can be in any country and do it in that country. You don't have to go to India to be a teacher. But over the years, one wants to go, I suppose, because that is the root of our tradition. And I have gone a few times to study with Mr. Iyengar and with his daughter, particularly his daughter Gita. His son Prashant also teaches, and all three of them teach in the original institute, which is in their backyard, has been there for many years. It's still there.
Wow.
We do need to go to Pune to study if we want to become a teacher who trains people to be teachers, or if we want to be somebody who's part of the international certification assessors team, then in those cases you do need to go to Pune. But I think for the most part, the people who go because they have a desire to pay their respect and to get the direct instruction from the person who is responsible for this particular way of working.
So when you went, I imagine.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like for you to meet Iyengar himself, and you know, what's his personality like? How was the practice like for you?
Well, I think to put it in context, I'm already maybe a third, fourth wave of teachers in Canada, because it's a tradition that has been here for a very long time.
Yes.
So I met him initially through his work, through studying with very good teachers who had studied with him. The first wave of teachers, there are a few senior teachers in Canada who were in that wave of teachers who went in the early years to study with Mr. Iyengar. In those years, at his studio, the institute there, there would be a few people in the class, and he would actually work with people one-on-one and in small groups, much smaller groups.
Mm-hmm.
By the time I wanted to go in the mid-90s, it was already a much larger international group of students. So I was lucky enough to attend the very last international intensive that he offered at the institute, which is a time when he stopped all the regular classes. They have daily classes there.
Mm-hmm.
And he would teach a three-week intensive. We would do, I can't remember exactly what it was, 6 hours a day or something, for 3 weeks. And to have that much attention and that much time with him was really a privilege. Because after that, they stopped doing that altogether, partly because the Iyengars are very committed to their own community.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the people that come to their regular weekly classes. And they realized that if they were going to continue getting international students to come for these international big intensives, that it's hard to keep the daily practice for their own people.
Mm-hmm.
So they changed that. They still have the international people coming. I mean, we still go, but we join their regular schedule. And it was a great privilege. Mr. Iyengar is a
mm-hmm.
He's a very fiery kind of person. He's seems large when you work with him, when you meet him. But he's actually small, he's short, and he has a very large, strong presence. He always has a twinkle in his eye. He's known to be a strict disciplinarian.
Yes.
And yet it's all relatively speaking. In comparison with his own teacher, Krishnamacharya, he's probably a lamb. Each generation has their product of their time,
mm-hmm.
their era, their generation, and I haven't experienced his famous wrath in a very personal, direct way, but he and his daughter work in this tradition of enormous respect for the elders in the community and for the teachers. And so when you go there, you just automatically fall into that. You could call it a hierarchy. It is a very strong hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And for some Westerners, it's challenging to work in that kind of system. However, I think once you... Shall we stop?
No, go ahead.
Okay. Once you're able to go with the flow, then you probably can see that it's a relative strictness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I recently saw a movie, Yoga Unveiled. Actually, it was a Drishti Point showing. And it traced all the teachers who had been trained by Krishnamacharya. And they had a lot of footage of interviews with Iyengar. And one of the things that I know he's famous for saying is practice, practice, practice. Can you talk a little bit about how that comes into how you teach?
Well, I think that yoga is an experiential philosophy. It's not something that one could do just as an academic sitting back on a chair. It is the knowledge of the work is in the work itself. So that doing the yoga makes one understand what yoga is.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how much you've read and how much you understand about it from an intellectual point of view, it has to be done to experience the benefits and the effects. And I think, you know, that has been his point. But isn't it something that those of us who do yoga absolutely know? It's innate in our bodies.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've heard that one thing that is very challenging for yoga teachers who teach as a profession, and even yoga teachers who have other jobs, is remaining committed to your own practice. How has that been for you, running and directing the studio?
It is the challenge of the work, I would say. Yeah, especially if, as you say, if you run a studio, what you've done is you've taken a yoga practice, you've added to it a teaching practice, and now you're adding to it running a small business. No matter how you try to get away from that concept, I think it's just practically true.
Yes.
So now you're having three things to take care of, and the balance is really important.
Mm-hmm.
And when you then start maybe also training teachers, you've got another component.
Mm.
So if what I have found is I have to always adapt what I do, the decisions I make, the time I spend in my life in general, to the foundation of the work, which is the practice. If I cannot get enough practice in, I am not as good a teacher as I can be. And the whole balance is out, and it's not really yoga anymore.
Mm.
So my commitment is absolutely to my practice. It's but that is the difficult thing to maintain. So, you know, if a younger teacher asked me for advice and said, how does one do it? I would probably say by making your time for your practice and by letting everything else build itself around that. And, you know, understanding as one does in one's body that's where the knowledge is.
So, Louis, over the break, we were just talking about balance between how we teach and how we practice, but you also mentioned a different kind of balance.
Well, yes, the balance inside of the practice. How do we balance our practice so that we know that all the systems of the body are well served, the nervous system, the digestive system, you know, how the quiet work, the active work, the balance of heat in the poses, which are the heating poses, which are the cooling poses.
Mm-hmm.
And that really in some ways there are no rules about those because every person is so different.
Yes.
And you look at what the person comes with, what each one of us comes with. Are we overheated types? Are we too passive in our types? You know, are we rajasic? Are we tamasic? Are we sattvic? What kind of nature do we have? And then to have the practice in such a way that it balances this individual out better.
Mm-hmm.
So for some people, doing lots of arm balancings and more flow might be exactly what they need to get energy flowing, of which there maybe is not enough or not enough manifestation in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And for other people, it's the other way around. You know, for some people, the most difficult thing you can give them to do is a restorative pose.
Yes.
You know, they want to crawl out of their skin. for some people, when Shavasana hits at the end of the class, the pose of the corpse, it's they're in heaven. And for other people, they're already thinking about somewhere else and being somewhere else, and they find that that's not their favorite pose.
Mm-hmm. So when you teach a class with so many different people, how do you manage a balance?
It's a very good question, I think, for each one of us to ask. But one of the ways I think I've been able to work with that is to not really work with drop-in students. Mm-hmm. We don't have a practice of where people drop in whenever they want and can. People sign up for a three-month course. And so I have the same students come for 3 months. Then I can plan. You know, I can say in month one, this is where we're going to go, in month two, in month three. And over the 3 months, I can build. And then it becomes, because I see the people then at least once a week mm-hmm. on a regular basis. And I can make sure that maybe not on day one, but then when we start, after we've done more of the standing poses, then we work more into the back bends and the twists and so on. Then the forward bends, lateral poses, supine poses, and then the inversions, which we take a lot of care in teaching a bit slowly, the headstand, shoulder stand, then we can sort of build on that and make it longer and more independent towards the end of the session if it were a beginner class, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if I had people drop in from week to week, it would be much more difficult for me. But one can still look at one given class and get a balance within that class, of course. And because every student cannot make every week every class because they have lives and things happen,
mm-hmm.
there is a way in which, and I'm sure many of the systems have their own way of looking at this, maybe these ways are not so different, but we have a particular kind of sequencing that works for us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for example, we never do headstand after shoulder stand. This is one of the golden rules we have. But we would do back bends after headstands. And so there are some scientific explanations as well to why these things are followed in a certain sequence. But I tend to want to let people do some standing poses. Well, first, you know, come in and center. Of course, that's classic.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Center, settle down, a bit of quiet time, meditation time, and then maybe more getting into the legs and getting that'll open up the spine, stretch the legs. So the standing poses.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, you know, there's creative ways of doing it. There are really no rules in the work, but by the end of the class, there should be a steadiness in the person, a calmness, a steadiness, joyfulness. You know, there's definitely a good recipe. The taste will be good.
Do you ever find that students get a certain look in their eyes when they come out of Shavasana?
Oh, yes.
Very satisfying, I would say, as a yoga teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I also would define part of the Iyengar tradition is a very precise way of alignment and using props to support when people can't get into poses so that alignment isn't off. And, you know, I've been to Iyengar studios and it feels like a yoga teacher in a candy store. Can you say a little bit something about how that supports the work that you do?
Yeah, well, the props, I think that's probably one of the things that made Mr. Iyengar well-known and famous early on, is that he developed props actually for two reasons. The one is more known amongst the general yoga public, and the other one is probably more known with people who are inside the Iyengar tradition, which is that it is to make the poses accessible for people who, as you mentioned, who can't quite get to that openness of the pose or the quality of that particular pose. But it's also props are used to deepen our work.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes for somebody who can already do a handstand, for example, and maybe they can already jump up with two legs,
mm-hmm.
then a prop might be used to take them deeper into it, make them give them more of a challenge, like put your hands on two bricks and then go up.
Mm.
So it's not just to help the ones on their way. It's also to take one to one's own newer, deeper level, wherever you may be in your development. And I love working in the studio where there's just what I need is there. Because every person, again, has different needs. Some people might not need a block under a hand or a strap around the foot, and others do. But to be able to give that to the person so they can get the fuller benefit of the pose is sort of a science of the work as well.
Wow. Well, it's been a real pleasure to have you here. And if people want to get in touch with you, how can they do that?
Probably the easiest way is to look us up on the website. It's www.theyogaspace.ca.
And your classes run for 3 months, so the next session will be starting in January?
We would sometimes let people start before the end of a session, and in certain classes that might be smaller or more basic levels. Or even for people who are very experienced, we will let them into an experienced level class. So people don't have to wait for the new session, but it depends a little bit on their availability and which classes are full. So the schedule is also on the web. We don't have a massive number of classes. We have about 20 classes a week, 7 days of the week. And it's quite a central location. It's actually near all the construction land of the Olympic Village. It's right there at Cambion First Area. So it's not too far for most people, and it's on the bicycle route, so that's really quite handy.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for coming down to talk with us, and we hope that you'll come back.
Thank you so much. Thanks for the invitation.
That was Louis Etting, and it is Farah Nazrallah here, 527. You're listening to Drishti Point on CFRO 102.7. And now we have a live guest in the studio, Dale Joal, who is a Kundalini yoga instructor, transformational breath coach, and also a laughter leader. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, Dale, I think you are the first person we've had on who has been a transformational breath leader or coach. So can you tell us a little bit about transformational breathing?
Yes, I can. It's a self-healing modality that is a very energizing breath. You know, in the West here, we have adopted a lot of yoga practices and ways to help us deal with stress by becoming more relaxed, and that's, you know, with long deep breathing and things like that. Whereas transformational breathing is, rather than the relaxation response, it's utilizing the what's called the arousal response. In other words, what we're wanting to do is we're wanting to get a person very energized by utilizing what's called a circular or a connected breath. And the connected breath is, there's no pause after the inhale or after the exhale, so a person is taking in lots of oxygen, really creating a lot of energy through the prana and the life force energy. And as a result of that, three things happen. Basically, on a physical level, what's happening is you're fully oxygenating your cells. And as you may know, that there's many diseases are caused by a lack of oxygen, mm-hmm. Anorexic or anaerobic diseases. It's been found that if cells are fully oxygenated, cancer can't exist, as an example. Mm-hmm. So on a physical level, it's really helping to strengthen your immune system, your respiratory system, your physical body in a tremendous way. And on a emotional level, what's happening is the breathing is like, let's say, for example, you're going up Gross Mountain. Mm-hmm. You know how you get kind of like out of breath? You're like very much, yeah,
yeah.
Like this? Well, it's that breathing without actually doing any physical exertion. So what's happening is the oxygen is able to go really, really deeply into your cells. Mm-hmm. And any emotional traumas are stored on a cellular level. So by having the life force energy or the prana go deeply into your cells, you're triggering those old emotional traumas, and you're stirring them up. And what happens is something that's called entrainment, where the a higher vibratory energy of the life force or the breath, mm-hmm. draws the lower vibratory energies of the trauma out and it transforms it. So
Hence
transformational breathing. And then on a spiritual level, you're creating a lot of openness.
Is this breathing technique used in any particular yoga, or is it completely separate and on its own?
I haven't, as far as I know, this is where this came from originally was, you may have heard of something that's called rebirthing, started by Leonard Orr. And the person who developed transformational breathing, her name is Dr. Judith Kravitz. She was a rebirther and had been doing rebirthing for, I don't know, like 10 years. Mm-hmm. And then she started to make some adaptations to the rebirthing process.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So,
When you first tried it, what was the experience that you had that then made you decide to actually become trained as a transformational breath coach?
Well, when I heard about transformational breathing, I was at a laughter yoga class actually with you, and I met a lady there, and we all went out for tea afterwards, and this lady mentioned, her name's Tina, she mentioned that she was going to be going to Cabo soon to do this transformational breathing training. And as soon as I heard the words, I knew that I needed to find out more information, because I had done rebirthing before. I'd also done holotropic breathing before. Mm-hmm. And intuitively, I knew that this was going to be similar to that. Mm-hmm. And at many different workshops, I'd done the connected breathing or the circular breathing. There's quite a few different names for it. It's called the Satori breath as well.
Mm-hmm.
So in those workshops, whenever I'd done like a breath session, it was always the most amazing experience I had for the whole weekend. So for me, what my experience was is that it was always this place of a huge emotional release,
mm-hmm.
and at the other side of the emotional release was this very calm and relaxed and centered and peaceful, blissful state. And so I was so inspired to want to have an opportunity to do that for like immerse myself more in that.
And did you find that a lot of your own emotional traumas and experiences from the past did come up and you were able to release them?
Yeah. In order to become a transformational breath practitioner, the first week you are there is to do work only on yourself. So in order to hold space for another person, you need to do the work on yourself. You know, it's kind of like, mm-hmm. If you're going to go to a therapist, the best therapist is one who's done their own work. You can only take a person as far as you've gone yourself.
Right.
So absolutely, that first week we're doing breath sessions twice a day for 7 days in a row. And there was a huge amount of healing there. And as I mentioned earlier, this is a self-healing modality. So once you've cleared the majority of your emotional trauma, through facilitated sessions, then you are able to do them on your own to maintain that level of openness and clarity.
So, tell us the changes and the results that you've seen in yourself and that you see in people who practice this on a regular basis.
Well, starting with myself, one of the main things is that I've noticed that I've struggled with depression a lot, and so for me it was definitely a lot of sadness that I had to release. So in releasing that sadness, but then the other piece I started to notice was that I could be in a really dark space, say, and I would be feeling like, you know, woe is me, really feeling like a victim, and like nothing was going to shift my day. And I would think, okay, I should do a breath session, because we're encouraged to do about 5 minutes of breathing every day. And I'm totally convinced that this time the breathing isn't going to make a difference. That's how my negative mind would be convinced, that there's nothing going to shift it for me today. And I'll start doing the breathing, and I'll often be so amazed at how the thoughts I was having that were so negative, like this negative loop that was going on, all of a sudden they would, it's like those thoughts aren't even possible to have anymore. It's like my vibration is so high, I can't have those thoughts anymore. And all I'm thinking about is solutions to problems rather than the problems, and having inspired thoughts versus all these, looking at, yes, yeah, so like starting to see the glasses half full versus half empty. It's just totally amazing. So now what I'm finding is that with the breathing, things that I would be worried or scared to say yes to, now I feel like I've got a tool in my toolbox that I can say yes to things I used to be scared of, because I know with the breathing, I can move through just about anything.
Wow, that's very powerful, just to hear your own story and the impact that it's had.
Thank you.
And we're back in the studio with Dale Joyal. You're listening to Drishti Point on CFRO 102.7 FM. It's 5:41, so we still have lots of time to hear more about transformational breathing. Dale, tell me, in what ways this has affected your life path?
Well, what I've been noticing is that the breath is a resource for me, and something in my toolbox is that it's caused me to feel like I've got something now that no matter what comes in my way, it feels like I know I can get through it with the breathing. And so as I was mentioning as we were off air earlier, is that I do about 5 minutes of breathing every day. And that's part of being a practitioner, is like maintaining that clarity and that clear ability to stay open and be present. And sometimes I will have this negative space. I've suffered with depression a lot in my life, and I've often seen the glasses half empty versus half full. I haven't considered myself like the optimist type person. And so sometimes when I get locked into that pattern and I feel like there's nothing going to shift it for me today, it's like, I got to do my breathing, but it isn't going to make a difference today. And yet what I find is that when I go and do it, and I'm in my breath session, I'll notice that, oh my God, those thoughts I was having, I can't even remember what they were. It's like the vibration, raising my vibration with the breath, all of a sudden, those negative thoughts cannot resonate. They just can't even develop or exist. And so they're gone, and they're replaced with basically the solutions to my problems that I was maybe focusing on earlier, and also more inspirational thinking, sort of like, I feel good. I get excited. I feel enthusiastic about what's my next step, rather than sort of the dread of, oh, another day. I'm all of a sudden excited about my day.
And this fits in with all the other things that you've done, yoga teacher training, Kundalini yoga teacher training, laughter leader. So how has transformational breathing helped you to figure out where your place is and how you're going to use all of those things?
Well, that's a beautiful question. In order of what I did first was I actually did Kundalini yoga teacher training first. And that was awesome in itself. But as I was taking the training, it's a very intense course. And about halfway through, I was feeling pretty grim. And I remembered laughter yoga, and I thought, I got to get myself to some laughter yoga classes. And so I specifically took some laughter yoga classes as I was taking that training to sort of balance things out a bit. And then, of course, I had the opportunity to take the laughter leader training with you and Alan. And through that, there was a whole paradigm shift for me around when I'm presenting myself, I don't need to be so serious. You know, it's in fact, it's good not to be. It's okay to lighten up. And so that, you know, that was sort of like the next step. And then with the transformational breathing, when I actually went to take the training, the lady, Dr. Judith Kravitz, her book that she wrote is called Breathe Deeply, Laugh Loudly. And so to me, it was like, this is so perfect, right? And while I've been doing the training, when I go to the trainings, I've offered laughter there. I mean, it was such a, it's like, to me, it was obvious. I had to, because she already wrote the book about how included laughter in that. And so to me now, it's what I find is with I guess with the laughter, at a laughter yoga class, as an example, there is the, well, you're faking it till you make it. That's kind of the thing, right? Well, so what I found is sometimes when I was doing that, it's like I needed to be able to move into the grief, the other side of it. What I find is there's a real polarity. You know, you're working mm-hmm. with both sides. Mm-hmm. And so with the transformational breath, it's given me that space to really go into those deep places of grief and sadness so that I can access even higher levels of my joy and through the laughter. And so that's where it's been a big support for me. And so, you know, I'm going to be doing some group sessions, and I'm seeing it as being that sort of that title is breathe deeply, laugh loudly. So I can see them tying together and maybe doing some laughter yoga in the breath sessions as well. Mm-hmm. So that's where I see them kind of coming together.
Wow. And something you said before that I want to get back to is you mentioned you spend 5 minutes every day. Is that all you need, 5 minutes?
Yeah. If I'm taking on a new person, basically what I like to do is I typically give a person an introductory session, and then after they've had their first session, I'll say to them, you know, this is a self-healing modality, so what we're looking for is we're looking to get you so you don't need me anymore, right? The recommendation is that they do approximately 10 facilitated sessions, mm-hmm. and then once they've completed that, during that time, I give homework in between. So even after the first couple of sessions, they can start doing their own 5 minutes a day, right? But by the end of the 10 sessions, then what I would recommend they do is 5 minutes a day and then one full session a week, which would be maybe more like a 45-minute session on their own as well, to really maintain keeping their energy and their chakra system balanced and clear of any emotional stuff that may come up for them.
But 5 minutes, once you've done the work, then it's 5 minutes, and that's not a lot. I mean, most meditation practices and yoga practices easily would be at least 40 minutes to start.
That's true. And I'm glad that you brought that up as far as other meditation practices and things, because what I want to be clear about is that even though transformational breathing is an amazing modality for creating the space for meditation, because a lot of times people struggle with meditating because they're so agitated.
Yes.
Right? So this is about clearing that agitation so that you can really be present for yourself in a meditation. And one of the things Dr. Judith Kravitz was very strong about was that doing your transformation of breath session is not replacing meditation. You need to continue with your meditation practice. So really what you're wanting to do is if you are on a spiritual path and you are mm-hmm. doing a daily practice, this would be an amazing thing to do prior to. That's what I do myself, is I do my breath session and then I go into my meditation afterwards. So that would be what I would recommend for people to do.
So it sounds like this technique has enabled you to really go a lot deeper into the things you've already been doing and experience just different levels in terms of yoga, meditation, and laughter.
Yes, absolutely. I'm definitely able to be a lot more present I guess gentler with myself. I'm just in a better space. I'm enjoying my meditation more, so it doesn't feel like I'm needing to discipline myself in the same way. It's mm-hmm. more like, oh, here I am, and then I feel very present and wanting to be in that space versus feeling like I'm disciplining myself and making myself do it because it's something I'm supposed to do for myself that day.
And, you know, another thing I want to get back to, because I thought that was an interesting point, is you mentioned the polarities. You know, I think sometimes when we think of meditation and these kinds of practices, we're always trying to get to the bliss place. But sometimes these techniques actually bring up other experiences, which we have to kind of get through or process before we can get to that place. So how do you understand the polarities and how they work together and how that manifests?
Well, how I understand it from my own experience is just, take, for example, laughter. laughter and joy is in your heart chakra, as is your grief, you know. So grief and laughter both come from the heart. And, you know, as you say in your laughter classes, if you laugh long enough, you're going to cry. And if you cry long enough, you're going to laugh. And so what I found is that, so I was leading laughter yoga classes or doing some laughter yoga with people that were doing transformational breathing. So my experience of them was that it was easier for them to get into a deeper place of laughter versus maybe the average person. So I think that even though we say to people, fake your laughter, it's just like, so here's the thing. I feel that when I'm faking it till you make it, I know there's a lot of people have resistance to that whole concept. They mm-hmm. want to be real, right? They yes. want to be authentic.
Yes.
And so if someone's coming to laughter yoga with a lot of sadness and they're trying to force themselves to laugh, I can understand their dilemma, right? Really, maybe what they need more so is to be able to process that grief and go into their sadness, which would be what transformational breath work could facilitate for them. So that, and once they clear that, it'll, then the laughter will come naturally. And so then it won't feel forced.
And when people process those kinds of experiences, like an experience of grief, do we actually go through all of the physiological ways that happen when we experience grief? Like, would a person in a transformational breathing session, if grief comes up, would they start to cry? Would they start to, in their body language, you know, shoulders coming in to protect their heart? Like, what happens physiologically when those experiences come up?
Well, it's a great question. No doubt that when a person is doing the transformational breathing session, what's happening is a person starts to move into authenticity. You know, you're basically, stuff's coming up, and unless they contract, the way they contract, and all of us contract, is by stopping breathing. So as a facilitator, what I'm doing is I'm continually getting them to breathe. So the resistance to breathing is the resistance to having those feelings.
I see.
So by continuing to encourage them to keep breathing, and this is something I also usually will coach them on prior to them starting the first session, is that oftentimes feelings will come up. And if they haven't cried for a really long time, as an example, I'm probably going to encourage them to just go ahead and move into that. Mm-hmm. But if someone is, you know, maybe by the third session, I'm going to say, okay, now what I want you to do instead is I'm going to encourage you to do your best to keep breathing rather than going to the feelings for a couple of reasons. Why is because when a person just goes into their tears, for example, or their sadness or their anger or their fear, whatever the feeling is, what will happen is as they express that in the moment, they will feel better because it feels good to express feelings, and it's much better than suppressing. But if they continue to breathe or do something else we call sacred toning, where you actually are just using a sound to help yourself get through the overwhelm of the feeling, mm-hmm. then what happens is you're actually clearing the trauma at a much deeper level and integrating it rather than just feeling good in the moment. So that's why I'm going to encourage people to just keep breathing through it,
okay.
so that they're not necessarily having to go fully into that feeling. Because sometimes when you go into a lot of grief, you can reinforce that.
I was just going to say, yeah.
Yeah. So this is a more empowering way to clear it and still feel good.
So it's not just the expression of emotion that's been trapped or repressed, but the moving through and the clearing.
Absolutely. It's moving through and clearing. And the other piece is that a lot of times people want to have the story, right? And think they should have a story about it. And, you know, that's a lot of times what cognitive therapy is about. You go and you talk about, right? You talk about what happened. And having the awareness is what's supposed to, you know, help you feel better. But in transformation breathing, we don't look at it that way. We look at it, it doesn't matter what the story is.
Mm-hmm.
Let's clear the trauma. And if you understand what that was about when you go through it, fine. And if you don't, it doesn't matter. It's kind of like, Judith Kravitz has used the analogy of if you were riding your bicycle all day in the rain and you went through a bunch of mud puddles and then you got home and you noticed there was mud on your elbow, you wouldn't need to go back and find out what mud puddle created that mud on your arm. You just wipe the mud off. And so that's the, sort of the same idea. We don't need to know what caused the trauma or where it came from. We're just getting, we're just letting it go. And so then it's done.
Very good analogy. Yeah. Well, we're coming to the end of our time here. So, Dale, if people want to get in touch with you or want to attend a group session, what's the way that they can do that?
They can call me at 604-314-9296. They could also go to the website www.transformationalbreathing.com, and I'm listed on there as a practitioner. I'm the only certified transformational breath practitioner in Vancouver, so they would be able to find my bio on that website as well, and much more information on transformational breathing.
Great. Well, thanks so much for coming into the studio. It was a little bit impromptu, but I'm really glad that it worked out.
Namaste. It's Farah again. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget to visit our website, drishtipoint.ca, for the best of the best Drishti Point podcasts. If you like this podcast and want to support our work, please consider becoming a Drishti Point member or making a donation of any amount to support the work we do to spread the light and love of yoga. We wish you health, happiness, prosperity, longevity, and vitality. Namaste.